From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're watching news from London. Parliament on lockdown after what's being called a terrorist incident on Westminster Bridge. The BBC is reporting that a car hit pedestrians on the bridge and that a man went to the gates of Parliament and appeared to go on a knife attack. According to the leader of the House of Commons, a police officer was stabbed. The assailant was shot. We'll bring you any further news as it comes.
Meanwhile, in Washington, if all goes according to plan, there will be a vote on the Republican plan to replace Obamacare in the House of Representatives tomorrow. President Trump is making a last-minute push to get House Republicans to support the bill. He spoke last night during a dinner hosted by the National Republican Congressional Committee.
That legislative effort begins with Thursday's crucial vote. And it really is a crucial vote for the Republican Party and for the people of our country.
But some Republicans think the current plan does not go far enough to undo Obamacare and remain opposed or undecided about how they'll vote. Joining us now for the latest is Allison Kojak, NPR health policy correspondent. And Allison, have there been any more changes to the bill to get more Republicans on board?
Hi, Jeremy. Yeah, there have been. Since this bill was released, the original language, a couple of weeks ago, and more so since the Congressional Budget Office released a report estimating that the bill would leave something like 14 million people uninsured after this year, there's been a lot of pushback, and pushback on both sides. So what they did, the Republicans did this week to try to bring in more conservatives is they added a work requirement to people who get Medicaid who are, quote, able-bodied adults. Right now, there's a lot of people who gained insurance through the Medicaid program, which is the government program for the poor. And this would allow state governors to require those people to either get a job or to do community service in order to qualify for their Medicaid benefits. There are a couple other changes that are more technical, but what they find is most people believe these changes would eventually make the Medicaid program cost less, and that is sort of designed to attract conservative Republican votes to this bill.
And yet there are still many conservative Republicans who are not going to vote for this bill. Among the firm no's on the health care bill is House Republican and former Freedom Caucus Chair Jim Jordan of Ohio. He told MSNBC's Morning Joe earlier today that it doesn't do enough to repeal Obamacare.
Unless there's real change, fundamental change, I do not see how they get to the 216 number that they need to pass it tomorrow night. So we're still willing to talk. We want to do what we told the American people we want to do. We're willing to work with them, but you have to do something that's consistent with what we told the American people, what we promised them we would accomplish when they gave us the privilege to come here and serve.
Now, if support does not start to pick up, what are the chances that this vote for tomorrow would be delayed?
It's unclear. I mean, right now it is scheduled. Nobody is talking about a delay on Capitol Hill. But it's really not great for the Speaker of the House to bring a vote to the floor that is going to fail. So we're hearing reports right now that there are members of the House who are at the White House meeting with the president. I'm sure there's some arm twisting going on trying to get those maybes and some no's back to yes.
Hmm. And then even if it does make it through the House tomorrow, there's the Senate, which many people believe is actually a bigger hurdle. Let's listen here to Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who told Martha McCallum of Fox News last night that the bill doesn't do enough, again, to undo Obamacare.
I am strongly persuaded that it's not going to pass. I think they should cancel the vote because they don't have the votes. I've been trying to tell them that for many days, and so far that hasn't been heeded.
And then there are other senators who, on the opposite side of the political spectrum, moderate Republicans who don't like the bill for other reasons. What are the chances of this passing in the Senate if it gets through the House?
Well, most of the smart money on that, I think, is no right now. As you said, there's pushback on both sides, and this is a really tough balancing act in the Senate. You have conservatives like Mike Lee, Rand Paul, or Ted Cruz who say they want to see a full repeal of the Affordable Care Act stop. And then there are moderates. Senator Susan Collins of Maine is one of them, who are more worried about the number of people who will end up not having health insurance if this bill passes and the repeal parts of Obamacare go through. And so it's really tough balance. And if this gets through the House tomorrow, there's a good chance whatever that language is, isn't going to make it through the Senate.
That's NPR health policy correspondent Allison Kojak, and we'll be watching what happens on Capitol Hill with the GOP plan to replace Obamacare. Allison, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, there are more questions today about former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort's ties to Russia. The AP is reporting that documents show that 10 years ago, Manafort secretly worked for a Russian billionaire to promote the interests of President Putin, including, according to a confidential strategy plan, pledging to influence politics, business dealings, and news coverage inside the U.S. This morning, Senator Lindsey Graham called the disclosure very disturbing if true, basically taking money to stop the spread of democracy. In addition, yesterday, a Ukrainian lawmaker accused Manafort of trying to launder money from corrupt Ukrainian politicians who'd hired Manafort to lobby for them. Manafort has acknowledged that he worked in Ukraine. He's said that lawmaker is extorting him. But he's also previously said he never worked for Russian interests. Jeff Horowitz co-wrote the AP story out today. And Jeff, Manafort has released a statement about your piece. He says he did work with this oligarch and Putin confidant, Oleg Deripaska. Manafort is a consultant, but he says you unfairly cast his work for Deripaska as inappropriate and nefarious. Your response.
So this is the first time that Mr. Manafort has acknowledged sort of that his work was not limited to political consulting work in Ukraine, as he's previously discussed, that it sort of ventured into working on behalf of a Russian oligarch who's very close to Putin. And when Paul Manafort is saying that he was working for the business and personal interests of this oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, I think that's going to raise with a lot of people the question of sort of how Deripaska's personal interests might differ from those of the Kremlin, given that Deripaska is, according to the U.S. government cables that were leaked a number of years ago, is one of Putin's lead lieutenants in the business world, in the Russian business world, is a frequent companion of his on trips, is sort of very heavily indebted to the Russian government.
Well, you've seen a confidential strategy plan and other memos, but we understand that the contract that he signed, you report, a $10 million a year contract, began in 2006. When did it end?
So we're unclear as to the timeline for the work that was done under that contract, and in fact, even how much work was done under that contract. What we can say is that starting in 2004 or early 2005, Manafort's firm, Davis Manafort Incorporated, started working for Deripaska covertly in supporting the Montenegrin independence referendum, which put Montenegro ultimately in the more in the sphere of Russia. Mm. And that work sort of continued to Ukraine, and then by the time that we get to sort of the memo and the memos and the contract we've got, Paul Manafort is proposing sort of this broad sweeping plan to undermine opponents of the Kremlin throughout Eastern Europe.
Yeah. But again, that might have ended as soon as 2009. He is credited with kind of saving the Trump campaign, which was having a hard time putting on the convention, getting people to speak. He did. But also during that convention, as we know, a plank in the Republican platform was changed. The plank that pledged to aid the Ukrainians who had overthrown the Russian-backed president that Manafort admits to working for. That was a very open consulting job that he had. That plank was drawn down. So, you know, what are we seeing here? What kind of dots can be connected?
So I think, you know, there are questions about how the support for the Republican Party's support for lethal aid to the Ukrainian government got dropped, lethal weapons aid. But what our reporting does show is that Paul Manafort, one, wasn't forthright about his connections with Russian interests. Two, that he had very substantial connections in Moscow with fairly high-level people. Oleg Deripaska certainly would count as that. And three, that he was quite willing and, in fact, was even proposing to back the interests of the Kremlin in a number of different countries surreptitiously. But we don't know if any of that actually filtered into his work on Donald Trump's 2016
right.
campaign.
Look, there's the other storyline. Yesterday, the Ukrainian lawmaker Sergei Lyshenko held up the invoice that he claims shows that Paul Manafort tried to launder $750,000 money that came from those corrupt Ukrainian politicians who were deposed. We know that there was that so-called black ledger that was found after they fled the country. One line showed a payment to Paul Manafort for $750,000. $100,000. Manafort has said those claims by Lyshenko are baseless, but there's also the fact that Paul Manafort's daughter's cell phone was hacked, all of her texts taken. Some of the texts show her saying things like, this money that our family is getting is blood money, but also do seem to show that that lawmaker was trying to blackmail Paul Manafort for information he had. This gets very murky very fast.
It does.
But the point is, it doesn't look good.
No, and that's certainly true. I mean, this is, look, the world of Ukrainian politics, trying to identify who the good guys are, who's backed by whom, this is not an easy thing, and it's definitely not black and white. And this is not the sort of thing that you want somebody who had played a formative role in your presidential campaign to be dealing with even after the election.
That's Jeff Horowitz. He co-wrote the AP story out today about Paul Manafort's previously undisclosed contract with the Russian billionaire and Putin confidant. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Homicide is the leading cause of death for African-American men aged 15 to 34. It's the third leading cause for all men in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control. Now, you may ask, why isn't that figure from the Justice Department? The CDC is responsible for health. Well, violent death is, of course, the ultimate health failure. And there is increasing momentum for a decades-old movement to treat it like a contagion, an epidemic, no different from any other that ravages a population. Gary Slutkin is a physician and infectious disease control specialist at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's also founder and executive director of Cure Violence, a nonprofit that aims to stop violence using strategies from the public health playbook. 30 cities are using the program with a mix of private and government funding. And Dr. Slutkin now joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And make your comparison of violence to a contagious disease.
Violence fits the definition of disease, and it fits the definition of contagious. The dictionary definition of disease is that it has characteristic signs and symptoms, and that it causes morbidity and mortality, meaning that it causes injuries or dysfunction or death. And the definition of contagious simply means that it causes more of itself.
Well, let me give you an example that we are hearing about. That, for instance, when a victim arrives in the hospital of a gunshot wound, for instance, a victim of violence, the staff knows that that means more violence is likely to occur, that there is going to be retribution, that there's going to be more of that violence, and that that victim in particular, maybe it's not immediate, but as many as 45% of people who go to the hospital after violent injury return within 5 years shot or stabbed again.
Right. This is exactly the way that many contagious diseases behave, as well as even non-contagious diseases if they're incompletely treated. If you get a person who has tuberculosis and he's in the hospital and he's treated and he isn't continuously maintained on what is required, he will relapse. Likewise for asthma or for diabetes. The only difference about a contagious problem is not only will that person relapse, but that there will be additional events in the community, additional tuberculosis events, additional flu events, in this case, additional violent events. You know, people call that retaliation, but really these are just the contagious nature of it.
So let's start with what the thinking is, if that's the theory. You send someone out to intervene immediately, as you would if you knew that somebody had a viral condition that would lead to an outbreak.
Well, in the first instance, you want to prevent a case of tuberculosis or flu or of violence. So in the first instance, violence interrupters as part of the cure violence model are out to prevent anything from happening by seeing early signs. For example, finding out what happened at a party or who is upset or who might be planning something. And these are like SARS or bird flu workers who are looking for first cases or to prevent first cases. But if there is a first case, someone was shot and we fail to prevent that case and that person is in the hospital, we not only talk with that person and then continue with him to ensure that should he live, that he not relapse. And that's by staying with him for 6 months to 2 years, modifying his thinking, his ways of responding in the future. And additionally, we're interacting with his friends, and those who might be preparing to do other events so that the contagion is actually stopped right there. So then that hospital, as you've mentioned, is not going to have a horrible Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday that would have been, in a way, the last event.
Why isn't this police work? Detectives are supposed to go and meet with people who might be their friends, their contacts. Why is this medical work?
It's public health. And the way that public health works is that you have health workers, and health workers are the ones who have the access to people whose behaviors you want to help change. So we have sex workers reaching sex workers. If you're talking about HIV/AIDS, you're talking about moms who are reaching moms for breastfeeding or nutrition, refugees reaching refugees in various situations, possibly related to cholera or tuberculosis. And here you have people who used to be involved in violent behavior now helping to access the people who are doing it or thinking about doing it. So this is a basic, essential public health technology. I mean, this is the same thing in Ebola. I mean, they tried police responses to Ebola and it spread. It wasn't until there were health workers who could talk to people, but why not to, you know, touch the person who is sick, how to bury safely. You know, these are very difficult behaviors. All these behaviors that we work with in health, violent behavior, sexual behavior, hand washing or sanitation behavior, very difficult behaviors to change. Violence, by the way, is not one of the harder behaviors to change.
Really?
Smoking behavior is much harder, and sexual behavior is much harder. The difficulty we're having in the realm of violent behavior really relates to the public's understanding of it, because it's still being mischaracterized as some kind of a moralistic problem rather than a scientific health-based problem. And we used to do this with other issues in health, too. The problem of violence is being misunderstood the way that we initially misunderstood AIDS. When AIDS first came in, we were judging these people, and it was all a moral problem, and the people who spoke about it were like religious leaders or political leaders, and then gradually got to have health people talking about it, and people saw, yes, it's actually a health problem. Because historically, we used to think that people with plague or leprosy were bad people, and we blamed them. And we're still struggling with the idea that people who have problems with substance abuse have, in fact, a health problem. So we've moralized a lot of things, including this. This is a health problem. It's an epidemic health problem, needs health workers.
Well, but let's take up that question I'm sure many are asking. There in Chicago, first of all, do you think this is working? Because on the face
Chicago
of it—
Chicago is the absolute proof of this.
How so?
Because it was what is being seen right at this moment in Chicago is the discontinuation of the cure violence approach in Chicago, which is called ceasefire there. But cure violence was discontinued in March of 2015 as a result of the state not having a budget. Cure violence went from 14 communities to one. Now, what about the one community where it has continued? In that community, the violence has continued to go down.
So you're saying that in 2015, the murders were already rising. There were 480, the most in Chicago since 97. But it jumped up to 762 in 2016. You draw a direct connection to these cure violence programs being cut because of budgets. But in the one community where the one program was left, the murder rate continued to decline?
Yes. This is described in a two-page summary and in a 20-page detailed report on when it happened and where it happened, and also all of the background here, because in addition, I mean, this doesn't happen out of the blue. There have been three published and four external independent evaluations of Cure Violence's work in Chicago, one done by the Justice Department, showing 100% drop in retaliations in five communities and 40 to 70% drops in shootings and killings. And there have been two other studies in Chicago. And twice before in Chicago, when funds were interrupted, it went up. And as soon as the funds were returned, it came down. Now, other cities are not having this kind of start-stop experience. I mean, New York City has had this in the budget since 2009. Los Angeles has an adaptation since 2006 that we helped set up. And there's about 25 cities using Cure Violence or some adaptation or replication of it.
Well, but these workers who work with the victims of violence, we understand part of what they do is try to help them get jobs, housing, stay with them to try to help them do the things that social workers do, it sounds like. But you also mentioned talking to friends to make sure you try to block that spread of the virus of violence. What about things like guns? You're still working with people who are still unable to leave this community.
Violence prevention, interruption, the work with the individual people is done by these new types of workers, interrupters, outreach workers, hospital responders, who not only have this special access, but they are very, very highly trained in how to cool someone down, how to buy some time, and how to shift their thinking, and then with time to give them new skills. So it isn't really about just a job or housing or all these other things, which are big problems and which we also try to help people with.
So you're not going to get rid of the guns, but you're somehow going to convince someone, don't feel you have to get revenge on that last shooting. It sounds like it's more along those lines. Don't pick up the gun.
But it isn't just don't do it. It's like helping the person cool down and helping them see the situation differently. And then, likewise, the particular behavior of violence can be shifted in spite of the conditions. Similarly, we've dropped rates of diarrheal disease. We've dropped malaria disease, even though the mosquitoes are all over the place. This is the specificity, power, and impact of public health in doing behavior change and in preventing the spread of epidemic processes.
Fascinating. That's Gary Slutkin, a physician and infectious disease control specialist at the University of Illinois at Chicago, but also founder, executive director of Cure Violence, the nonprofit that we'll link you to at hereandnow.org. Dr. Slutkin, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Perhaps you've heard the news that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson didn't want the job he now holds and didn't seek it. That comes from the one reporter who was allowed to travel with him to Asia, Aaron McPike from the conservative news site IJR, or Independent Journal Review. IJR is also in the news right now because it just retracted a story that suggested a ruling by a federal judge in Hawaii that blocked President Trump's revised travel ban last week was influenced by former President Obama's visit there. The publication has suspended the author of that story and two of his editors. For more, we're joined by NPR's David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And tell us more about what happened here at IJR.
Well, so it's a conservative millennialist site, as you say. They posted this story about Obama, and it sort of was a reflection of a split within the site. You have more serious pieces like the one, to be fair, done by Aaron McPike from that trip with the Secretary of State, a pretty good piece, actually, in retrospect. And you've got then these viral stories, and a lot of this is based on some really terrific piece by Oliver Darcy in Business Insider. But he was able to reveal the pressure on them to serve essentially red meat for conservatives. Online readers really ginned up the process there. One of the editors was interested in this idea of, hey, was this Hawaiian federal judge somehow connected with Obama? Somebody in their internal messaging group on Slack said, that's unsubstantiated. It's complete conspiracy theory. No fact to it. And he said, I'm going to assign somebody to do that story anyway. Ultimately, when that was fleshed out, he was suspended, as was a reporter, another editor, as you say. But nonetheless, it's a sign of the intense desire to serve a conservative pro-Trump audience out there, some way of damning his critics and of the judges who are trying to provide a stop to him in certain ways.
Which brings us to the other story that's kind of related to this, which would be at Fox News, which has pulled Judge Andrew Napolitano off the air after he made unsubstantiated claims that a British intelligence agency helped former President Obama wiretapped then-candidate Donald Trump. Napolitano, who is a senior judicial analyst for Fox News, said this last Wednesday on Fox Business.
Did the British CIA, as I keep calling it, the GCHQ, actually do this? They say no. The intelligence sources with whom I spoke say yes. I don't know if the investigators will get to the bottom of it.
And then 3 days later, Fox News' Shepard Smith said this on air.
Fox News cannot confirm Judge Napolitano's commentary. Fox News knows of no evidence of any kind that the now president of the United States was surveilled at any time in any way, full stop.
And now, as we said, Judge Napolitano has been pulled off the air. Are these isolated incidents, or do you see this as a moment for conservative media outlets?
I think, you know, Fox very much has the presentation and bunting of a traditional news organization, but the opinion and punditry tail wags the dog. And so you have people who are serving in what sounds like a journalistic role, a guy like Napolitano, but providing really a kind of point of view. At one point, he said Fox News can report this. Hmm. Fox News couldn't report that, and Fox News hadn't vetted that. And you're seeing a point at which their sympathies and their desire to serve an audience that's sympathetic to Trump is coming into conflict with the repertorial notion that they've been providing the public as well. And I think you're seeing real tension there.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
It's an exciting and maybe scary time of year for high school seniors. They're waiting for acceptance letters from colleges. Juniors are focusing on college prep and taking the SAT. But what about sophomores? They're often left out of the college conversation, and Lisa Maselli says they shouldn't be. She's director of college counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, my high school. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. I'm excited to talk to you about this topic.
Well, and this topic is sophomores. Isn't that a little early to start thinking about college?
You know, this is why this year is so fun to start the conversation, because it's non-threatening. There aren't a list of to-dos, and it really can engage the students and the parents in a fun way of setting a healthy foundation.
Well, you say there isn't a list of to-dos, but give us some to-dos. What should the sophomores be doing right now?
Right. Okay, you're right. I guess I should call them tips, because we definitely have many sophomores who dipped their toe into practice exams. So for the sophomores out there who did take a practice ACT or a practice to the PSAT, which they'll be sitting for again as a junior, correct those mistakes, sophomores. Talk to your teachers. If you don't know why you got that math question wrong, if you don't correct it, you'll do that same mistake again. I also think that they oftentimes don't use the free online resources, Jeremy, to do test prep. Now that things like Khan Academy are partnering with the College Board, they really are trying to kind of even the playing field so that test prep is not just for those who have the privilege of paying for it. I'll tell you a tip that the sophomores aren't going to like, and that is they have to start just journaling their thoughts about who they are as a person. We always tell students, don't grab a college list guide and start naming colleges off. You have to know who you are before you build that list. So it's really important for them to pretty much just start that journaling and to also learn how to take the lead so that they develop these self-advocacy skills. And what I mean by that is, let's say, Jeremy, they want to apply for a summer camp, and the parent calls and says, hi, will you write a letter of recommendation for my son who wants to study chemistry out east? What do you think the response from that teacher is going to be? So we do try to tell students it's time for you to step up and learn how to take initiative with your teachers and your education.
What about over the summer? Should they be doing more things over the summer, since now it seems like the idea of college prep is kind of a year-round thing?
Yeah. I mean, nowadays they are looking to see how students choose to spend those summers. I like to use the phrase reclaim your joy, because I think what happens in the busy, busy school year is lots of kids will actually say, boy, I haven't read a book for enjoyment for 9 months because I'm so busy with schoolwork. Or I used to do photography and I haven't had a chance to really do that before. So what we try to help students and parents understand is you can actually frame out a nice summer that actually thinks about your intellectual needs, your social needs, also your need for downtime and fun. It's so important to be balanced, but there's a lot that students can kind of dip their toe in, and also not overlook the fact that sometimes just doing typical teenage stuff, like finding that summer job or helping your neighbor cut the lawn, is also something that shows kind of character and who you are. And those activities, too, can be listed on a college app.
And we're talking here about sophomores who are college-bound or who would like to be college-bound after high school. There are probably a lot of people out there who are high school sophomores who aren't planning on going to college or may not be able to go to college.
Yeah. And I would say, too, for those sophomores who maybe are trying to even think about what their future is going to be, keep in mind the high school experience is a 4-year journey. And I think what happens sometimes for sophomores is they get kind of left in the shuffle. So we really want sophomores to realize it's time to celebrate you. It's time to actually start thinking about what are things you maybe want to explore more deeply and start thinking more about your natural curiosities. And I think for any student, whether they think college is in their future or not, hopefully someone is sitting down and having those conversations to really show them that they care about them and that they want to help them think about what life after high school will look like.
Well, what should parents be doing for their sophomores in this crucial time?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you some tips that we give parents that often shock them. We tell them, one, stop doing your kids' laundry. And they look at us like, what does that have to do with early college planning? And we basically say, okay, we're going to channel Julie Lithcott-Hames, who wrote this awesome book called How to Raise an Adult, Put Independence in Your Kids' Way. Because by the time we work with them on college apps and how to get ready for an interview, they'll know how to manage steps in this process without your hand-holding. So parents often are like, wow, we never thought of that. The second tip.
And they probably love that idea, too. Because...
Yes. As a matter of fact, Jeremy, the funniest part is we talk with sophomores later to tell them what we're telling their parents. And we walk in the classroom and say, we just told your parents to stop doing your laundry. And they look shocked. But it is kind of in jest, but it's fun to talk to them about independence. And then the second tip we tell parents is throw more dinner parties. And again, they look shocked because we tell them all the time to avoid the cocktail circuit and watch out because a lot of gossip and misinformation gets passed around sometimes. But what we're saying is put more adults at the table that your children don't know so that they learn how to engage in the art of small talk. Because a lot of this process, Jeremy, especially if they interview, is not prepping for an interview and sound like you've been, you know, marketing questions to actually say to an interviewer. It's the art of small talk. How do you have a conversation with someone you don't know that you can walk into a room and feel confident? So that's a skill set we would love sophomores to start.
And we will put some tips for sophomores and their families at our website, hereandnow.org. Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana. Thanks so much, as always.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Well, the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act has a lot of people wondering about their own coverage, including those with chronic illnesses like asthma. About 1 in 12 Americans has asthma, according to the Centers for Disease Control. For black youth, that rate doubles to 1 in 6. Diamond Eugene is one of those young people, and Youth Radio's Amber Lee spent time with her in San Francisco to find out how she manages her asthma and how she deals with health care.
Maybe you know someone who has asthma. A kid who sits out on the mile run in PE class, or who has to use an inhaler, or you have asthma yourself. I'm at the apartment of 20-year-old Diamond Eugene. Her asthma is pretty bad.
It's like a disability, because it's like you can't do much. You can't really have like a full life.
Diamond has a long list of things she can't do. She says she can't go jogging, can't go swimming, can't go to the park when there's a high pollen count. Here's Diamond's mom, Dorothy Blakely.
If we'd have a sunny day and then it turned cold and windy instantly, she's going to get sick. So there's times we saw the clouds coming and we were running, trying to outrun the clouds, trying to run home to get her home because the asthma's already starting to show up.
Diamond's mom also has asthma. She remembers the first time she noticed her daughter wasn't breathing well. Diamond was just a baby.
I was having an asthma attack and she was having one and I was shocked with her. I'm like, do you have asthma?
Diamond's health is pretty complicated. In addition to asthma, she has chronic migraines and she's a cancer survivor. She beat Hodgkin's lymphoma in her teens. Right now, Diamond has insurance through Medicaid. She used to go to the emergency room for care. Now she goes to an asthma clinic and has a healthcare worker, Stephanie Williams, who makes home visits.
I have my medicine box and I'm just going to give it to you.
Okay.
Press. And then...
During this home visit, Williams helps Diamond's family out with things you wouldn't think contribute to her asthma, like housing insecurity.
So this is basically a below market rate building, and they're accepting applications right now for it. And so if you can, you guys can go on the website and apply. There's a lottery.
Williams is not only looking at Diamond's physical environment, but social factors too. In medicine, this approach is called a medical social model. Diamond, her baby, and her mother all live in a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. It's cramped, and Diamond says she doesn't feel safe. The healthcare worker, Stephanie Williams, takes many things into consideration as part of Diamond's care. She isn't just looking at mold or cigarette smoke to decrease asthma symptoms. She also considers other parts of Diamond's life, the joys and the stresses. Here's Williams.
Especially for kids who have asthma, something as simple as stress or laughing or crying could actually send you off into an asthma episode.
While preventions like stress reduction have made a difference for Diamond, she's not sure how healthcare reform will change things for her. The Republican draft bill in Congress includes a rollback of Medicaid expansion. So what would Diamond do if she lost her coverage?
It's either, you know, pay rent or pay for medicine or, you know, get food or pay for medicine.
Even though she doesn't know yet how her care might change under the GOP plan, she knows she'll always have to deal with her asthma. For now, she's using the resources she has to improve her health and do things she says healthy people her age have an easier time doing, like finishing school. For Here and Now, I'm Amber Lee.
The confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch is getting most of the attention this week, but there are other goings on Capitol Hill. Today, the Senate and House Veterans Affairs Committees held a joint session to hear the concerns of American vets from a number of groups, including Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA, which focused attention on the challenges faced by the country's female vets. This is a growing population with 345,000 women deployed since 9/11. Overall, there are 2 million female veterans. Allison Jaslow is chief of staff at Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and served two tours in Iraq. She testified today. Allison, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? How did today go?
It was great, you know, and as I was telling your producers before this, it's a sunshiny day in Washington, D.C., and nothing makes me happier.
Yeah, well, there's that. Well, you were part of a panel of 9 veterans groups. There were only 2 that were represented by women, including you. You were one of them. Now, some people might say, well, 2 out of 9, that's about right for the equation, for the balance. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, we weren't the first panel that's been before Congress discussed veterans issues, so I don't know exactly what proportion we do across the board. But I will say, you know, it's great to hear not only more members, more senators, and some of our colleagues on the panel today talking about women's issues, but understanding that there is still a disparity, even if we as a nation want to treat all veterans equally and make sure that they all have the support that they deserved and earned, we still have a long way to go when it comes to women veterans.
Well, you pointed out in your testimony, this is metaphor, but the VA motto that greets people when they come in for treatment is, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. Of course, we do care for the hims who've borne the battle, but your new hashtag is she who borne the battle. What is it exactly that female veterans want from the VA?
So I will first like to make sure that I highlight the issue of recognition when it comes to women veterans. In IAVA's most recent member survey, just 27% of IAVA women veterans feel like the public understands their sacrifice and their service. And this extends to the VA. That's why we've really focused in on the change of the motto. Without having recognition and culture change that must start at the top, which has to do with the tone that we set, even on the sign around the door on the way in, can we not get the full support that the women veterans need within those VA facilities?
Right. So it's just even thinking, being reminded that women are involved. And are there special medical issues, for instance, that female veterans need that maybe, you know, the VA, which has had so many problems, you know, just isn't up to speed on yet? What are some of your other concerns?
Well, you know, I'd say that no different than men and women elsewhere in America, there are unique biological differences for men and women. So making sure that we actually take a data and a approach to seeing and making sure that we have the support for women based on what, like, science tells us is the first step. But, you know, outside of that, just making sure that women veterans are able to navigate the VA system is one of the biggest challenges to making sure that they get the care that can be provided for them, in addition to making sure that they can get the full array of services that you can get in the private sector in the VA, which is what, you know, comes commonly for male veterans. Yeah. Things like mammography, screenings and, you know, other sort of female-specific care.
Yeah. And you have said, and others have said as well, that more women in leadership positions will, you know, fulfill some of these needs. But we're having this conversation as there are new reports that despite the military investigation, that secretive group of current and former Marines, some are still sharing explicit photos of active duty women and veterans. You know, we spoke to former Marine Captain Angie Morgan about this scandal, and she says it doesn't represent the values of the Marines that she knows. But there are Marines continuing to do this. Your thoughts?
You know, I think every time I'm asked about this issue, the one thing I want to make sure folks remember, at least for me, is the power of command climate. I firmly believe that soldiers, Marines, airmen aren't going to do, with the exception of a few bad actors, things that they don't feel like will be tolerated. And so it has to start with the top. As somebody who's served myself, I've heard all too often language that is insensitive to women. And, you know, when you are wearing the uniform yourself, it's unfortunate that you're forced between the decision of being ostracized for speaking up or being somebody who figures out a way to kind of muscle through the commentary, blend in with the boys, so you can get the credit for your service and your contributions that you deserve. You know, I would suspect that still today, even though we've got women integrated into combat roles, that if you don't really have commanders, and especially the men in uniform who are next to these women who have to endure and tolerate insensitive language speaking up, we're really not going to get the change that we need, and we're not going to stop incidents like these.
That's Alison Jaslow, Chief of Staff for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA, which, by the way, put her forth to testify today about Veterans Affairs. She's a veteran of the Iraq War. Alison, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.